and welcome to the UCB Theater New York podcast. My name is Will Hines, and joining me this week is a special co-host, Shannon O'Neill.
Hello, America.
Yes, thank you, America, for welcoming Shannon. John Frusciante couldn't be here this week. So Shannon, thank you for coming in. We're going to talk a little bit about shows going up this week, and then we have a special guest with us, Mr. Chris Gethard. Hello, Chris.
Hi.
Yes, thank you for being here.
He's slightly retarded today.
No, I'm good. I'm just sitting in a weird booth.
Yeah, the normally already weird UCB podcast tent that we use, these two felt walls with a green screen over it. Today there were no classrooms available in the UCB Training Center, so we are in an electrical closet, for real.
That's also a storage room of chairs from the 22nd Street Theater.
Yeah, and so there might be weird dripping noises, and there might be machines that start buzzing, because we've never done the podcast in here, so that's something that could happen.
The dripping noises are from us, though.
Yeah, the dripping noises will be
there
things
will
that,
be dripping noises, yeah, not we, could be.
Right, we will be emitting dripping noises for sure. But,
So real quick, we should talk about what's at the
what's
theater
the theater this
week.
So, yeah.
Pew, pew!
So we have the Friars Club competition is happening Friday and Saturday.
Frisk.
And we're in this, and I don't even know quite what this is.
It is the, yeah, it's the Frisk competition.
Friars sketch comedy or something? Or like
yeah, Friars Club sketch comedy, yeah.
Or
so it's like FRI for Friars Club and then sketch.
And comedy or
something? I is for improv? I don't know.
We don't know.
We're in it, though.
We're in it, though. The Stepfathers, which is our improv group, is in it, along with Badman and then a couple of groups from L.A., like I think the Midnight Show. Oh, the Midnight Show is one of the sketch groups.
Yeah.
Well, Friday night there's going to be improv groups competing and then Saturday night sketch groups competing. And the Friars Club is going to give
the winner
of each night $10,000 to make a short film, I guess?
Yes.
That is correct. One for the improv winner, one for the sketch winner.
Yep.
Yeah, and they had like 100 entrants, I think, either in both categories. And like I say, the Stepfathers and the Badman from UCB. You don't know who else is. I know the Midnight Show from L.A.
It's a two-person group from L.A. The John and Eddie Show.
Okay.
It's an improv show.
It's two girls.
Okay.
It's two girls.
Okay.
Girls.
Well, all I do know is that
improvise.
If the Stepfathers win, we're going to spend about $300 on that video and split the $9,700.
Yeah, that is the plan.
That is the plan. And I hope if the Friars Club hears it, I'll tell them I'm joking. Not joking.
Yeah, not joking. The $300 will give Delaney like the most expensive webcam to talk about what Robert Altman film he likes the best, and the rest of the money is going to go to us just hanging out or doing whatever.
Yeah, just kidding, Friars Club.
Just kidding, maybe not.
So that's the Friars Club competition.
And then the Del Close Marathon is a month away, but there's going to be a bunch of special workshops that week. It's the last week of July, and those are going to be announced the end of this week on the message board, boards.ucbcomedy.com. We're like still finishing scheduling all of them, but a lot of the guys from LA who are coming back are going to be teaching. Some of the teachers here will be doing special workshops. Some sort of like people who don't teach very often, like John Lutz, will be doing one. And
oh, that's great.
Yeah, so they'll be announced by Friday on boards.ucbcomedy.com.
June 25th.
I'll be
teaching some if I ever stop being a baby and get you dates that work.
I think we finally worked that out.
I don't know if I haven't stamped off on those yet.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you haven't answered
yet.
We'll
talk after this.
You're one of the people we're waiting to finalize this.
Yes.
Thank you for owning up publicly. Okay, so that's the week's news. The little organization happens in this podcast is all from John. I got to say, like, he's the one who actually always knows what's going on. John, I'm sorry I make fun of you when we're not recording this. All right, so let's move into the interview portion. Our special guest this week, Chris Gethard. Chris, you are, of course, one of the popular teachers and performers here at the theater. You're on the Stepfathers, a group that Shannon and I are on with you. Been teaching here for a long time.
Thankfully, we're not all on Reuben Williams together, though.
Oh, God, yeah, that'd be the worst.
Yeah,
Reuben Williams, it's a disaster. Disaster of a team.
Yeah, in case you're...
Wait, the first liquid, you guys hear that?
Rushing above our heads, yeah. Someone either turned on a sink or flushed the toilet. For people, we're mentioning Reuben Williams, a lot of people probably don't know who they are.
Yeah,
so
they're a very obscure
improv
team.
The way the theater's kind of built is, you know, you take a lot of classes, then you can audition for a Harold team.
Right.
When you're on a Harold team for a number of years,
sort
of like if you're pretty good, you go to Reuben Williams, and if you're very good, you go to the Stepfathers.
That's the established process.
Yeah.
So a lot of people who follow the New York improv scene probably have never heard of Reuben Williams, so that's good to clue people in on that.
I had forgotten about them.
And Chris, you also, and you've been here for like forever. We're gonna.
They're the group that's after Ruru and before the Andy Rocco hipster show.
Oh, the hipster show.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah. And Ruru's great.
Yeah.
And Chris, you lately, Your current project, of course, is the Comedy Central show Big Lake.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? What's that about?
What's that about?
Like, what is it?
The Big Lake is a sitcom. It's the first sitcom Comedy Central's ever doing. I'm the lead, which is bonkers.
It's crazy.
It's really crazy. We can talk about that if you want.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's with Horatio Sanz and Chris Parnell. Those are the other two main guys. And then Dylan Blue, Deborah Rush, and Jim Rebhorn play my family. And we filmed 10 episodes in 6 weeks.
That finished relatively recently.
We wrapped 2 weeks ago. I'm still doing like a whole bunch of voiceover stuff. And it will air in August.
Yeah.
They're thinking, I don't know, actually, I don't know if I'm allowed to say which dates they're thinking of.
August 14th, I saw on the Comedy Central.
It keeps getting switched. August 3rd, maybe August 17th.
So sometime in August, this show will debut.
They're just trying to finalize which day in August it's going to be.
It was on your talk show thing and came up on that.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Sometime in August, so that's exciting. Although in this podcast, I like to focus on a lot of on the improv side of things, sort of the UCB side of things. So we'll definitely touch on that. But
you don't have to.
Fuck your success, man.
Yeah, fuck your success.
No, let's sit in an electrical closet and talk about improv instead.
It's much more in line with the way you've spent most of your adult life, anyway.
Yes, 10 years of doing this in the hopes of something catching on. Something does, and now I'm here sitting in a tent talking to you.
I felt like your 6 weeks of success was going to your head, and you needed to be humbled. Oh. So Shannon and I are dragging you into this closet.
That's the opposite of what's true. Well, my assumption is that my life is going to be like Flowers for Algernon.
Like you'll just revert to
now
a retarded
I go back
state?
To being retarded.
You don't know how to work the baking machine.
Sorry,
anymore?
Improv students, that I just referred to that era of my life as retarded.
Well, let's.
It was just an analogy.
First, few people remember that book because most people keep reading books after high school, so they're not all going to remember the book like you do to use that as a reference.
I'm staring at you like I have no idea what you're talking about.
Flowers for Algernon?
Yeah, never read it.
Oh my God, you would actually.
You'd love that
book.
You
would think it's one of the saddest books ever. You would think it's one of the funniest books ever. You've never heard of this?
I've heard of the book.
It's a retarded guy, and they find a cure.
Oh, I'm going to go buy a Kindle
and
download
it right
now.
It's his diary.
It's his diary, but then he starts reverting. He starts realizing that the medicine doesn't work anymore, so he's like smart enough to realize he's getting retarded again. You, Shannon O'Neill, would love it. It would be your favorite book.
Yeah,
you would think it was the funniest
book. You'd probably view it as a comedy.
How have I not read this?
I will take you to Borders. After this, you and I are walking across 7th Avenue to Borders, and I'm buying you a copy of that, and you're going to cry laughing on the subway.
It's not like super mandatory reading in high school, but it is like a common sort of like second tier book that a lot of high school English classes throw out for some reason.
Okay.
And there was a movie in the early 70s, so it got big for a while.
Yeah,
we can just talk
Charlie.
About that for a while. Charlie, Cliff Robertson or something.
All right. Any hoots.
Chris improv. Gethard. So what we usually do here when we get someone, why don't you talk about how you got into improv? Like, why don't you talk about how you entered into the world of comedy and improv in particular?
Sure. I, let's see. I was in high school. And my town only had like musicals and stuff, and in eighth grade I did one, and I really liked being on stage, and I weirdly wound up being the lead because the cool kid Danny Tobia dropped out, so that's the first time I wound up on stage because I was a nerd and had the whole play memorized. So I played.
Which was this?
This was Bye Bye Birdie. In eighth grade I played Conrad Birdie, who was an Elvis-like character, even though I was like 4'6". Shannon has seen videos of it. It's really weird. It's really fucked up.
Yeah, he has to yawn to pretend he's bored. And the video of Gethard yawning is him just like opening his mouth really wide and then shutting it.
It looks like I'm dying of lockjaw on the stage.
He looks like one of those catfish sucking the side of an aquarium.
Yeah, like an algae eater, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I knew I loved being on stage, but I only had these dumb musicals to do in high school. But this teacher who taught the drama class in my school grabbed me. She's like, "You need to take my class. I'll make it worth your time." And she had us just do improv the whole time. And I loved it. And then when I got to Rutgers, I wanted to keep doing it. And they had a short form group, which I auditioned for, didn't make the cut, didn't even get a call back. The director of that group is Jamie Rivera, who was on Team Here and is now performing at the Magnet very regularly.
Yeah, he's in junior varsity at the Magnet. He was on Trillion Here. He's your...
My current roommate. I auditioned 2 semesters in a row. The second time I got a call back, just wanted to do it. Finally got in, did short form for like a year. I'm like historically a very angry and depressed person, and it always leads to me like feeling like I need to do something else. So did short form for a year and liked it, but thought it was just pretty like lame and the same stuff. So when I was a sophomore in college, started coming and taking classes at UCB over the summer, and that was 10 years ago, over 10 years now.
Were you like comedy nerd at all growing up? Were you one of those kids like comedy connoisseur, like listened and watched movies and dug up old Mad magazines or anything?
I wasn't like Delaney where I was like audio taping SCTV commercials and stuff like that. But my brother was a huge comedy nerd. My brother like had a subscription to Mad magazine. He had great taste, really into SNL right there in like the, you know, Phil Hartman era. And sorry, Will Hines is being super distracting right now, everybody. Sorry. I'm much smarter than this. He's just being distracting. But yeah, my brother liked that old Letterman. He was really into Letterman. We both loved pro wrestling, and that got me super into Andy Kaufman. So I was never like a connoisseur, I would say. There's people who I think have that. My brother, I think, was more so. But my whole family's funny. But I just kind of, I sort of obsessively love certain things.
So then you got to UCB and you liked it pretty much right away. Like, I remember you entering the scene and then kind of being around all the time, like, right away. It's like, you're one of those guys that got obsessed early.
Yeah, I mean, I also, I know it's like, I don't want to sit here whining, but I also was at Rutgers and I was completely depressed. Like, if there was, I found someplace else to go and that was UCB and I was there all the time. So it really helped out. I remember, like, I would come up every week I'd be taking at least one class at a time, was rehearsing with my indie group, and would go watch Harold Knight every week, usually go watch Pile Driver every week, and then every Friday at midnight, I would drive up and go to the jam that Respecta was hosting at the time, and every week I'd be like, I'm gonna get on stage this time, I'm gonna do it. Did you wanna jump in?
Oh yeah, Shannon and I, when she was on this podcast, we talked about this. I remember seeing you and Tarek, Davis, at one of them, because you and I started at roughly the same time, and yeah, it was terrifying to get up
yes.
there.
Yes. You started like 6 months before me, right?
Yeah.
That's it.
I think that's right. I feel like my level three, you were in level one.
Yeah, I think so. I think you were just getting, I think Monkey Dick, because Monkey Dick, yeah, you must have just gotten on the legendary top shelf Harold Team Fire Hot Burn when I was, I think, right as I was starting.
Yeah, that's probably right. Or just after that. But anyway, I remember going to those jams, and they were terrifying. I remember specifically seeing you and Tarek sitting there, and the three of us, none of us got up the whole time.
No, I would go every week. Tarek, I mean, if he came with me, he would come every once in a while, but I would generally go by myself. I would drive, like, my shitty old car up and sit there and be like, I'm going to do it, and then I would get too scared to not do it, and I'd drive 45 minutes back to New Brunswick, New Jersey, and the whole time would be, like, talking out loud, being like, you're a fucking pussy. You're such a fucking pussy, like, yelling at myself. It was crazy. And then the first time I got up, I jumped up on stage, said something about Captain America, and Dynamo immediately tagged me out, and I was, like, crushed.
Yeah.
Crushed. So, yeah. That was how I got started at UCB. Just, yeah, came all the time. Almost immediately dedicated my entire life to it.
So when was the time early on when you started to feel like, oh, I'm pretty good at this? Or when did you have any kind of reassurance that, oh, I fit in here and this is a place for me?
Let's see. I guess it was sort of like, I don't know. In my experience, it wasn't like that just clicked. There would be like fleeting moments of that, you know? There was a guy named John Ross Bowie, who you know, who I think a lot of people in New York probably aren't as familiar with. He's in LA now and does a lot of stuff at their theater, but he took me under his wing pretty hard, and that made me feel like I was on the right track because that guy has good taste, you know?
Yeah.
So you could like see somebody else who's making good decisions decide on me, and that kind of reassured me. And then, yeah, what else? I don't know.
Bowie was on Pound with Rob Corddry, Seth Morris, Brian Husky. Their group, the Naked Babies, they were like kind of big guns at the theater.
Yeah.
Like their group
They're
was sort of like
the forgotten big guns, because everybody always talks about the Swarm and Respecto and there was Mother, but then the Naked Babies was like the other group that kind of, that was like the other.
They were
big,
huge. Like they did like sketch the shows.
Group, yeah.
Yeah.
They were hilarious improvisers. They were teachers feature, and coaches.
They were at the core of Feature, which was one of like the big improv shows to learn from. They did the movie. But yeah, the Naked Babies looked out for me in that, especially Bowie, and that made me feel like I was on the right track.
And I'm pointing this out, for Bowie to come and pay attention, he would be like, as a student, you'd be like, oh wow, like one of like the big guys of the community is paying attention.
Yeah, that would be like if Neil Casey took you under his wing. It would be though.
No, it would. I don't know why we're laughing. It does seem adorable to make that comparison, but that's true.
Yeah, so then that happened. Then we got on Joe Ross Tribe, Shannon and I.
So both you and Shannon were put on Harold teams at the same time. Were you guys friends before being put in the Joe Ross Tribe together?
We knew each other.
Yeah. Kevin Mullaney was both of our... We took level one at the same time, not in the same class. Then Mullaney had organized, like, a supplementary class. And Shannon showed up for the first week, and I remember she was there in what I still think of as like a super Shannon moment. You were the first one there, I was the second one there, and you were setting up chairs when I got there. It was like really badass and dedicated. But then you stopped coming because you met your husband.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I think you came to 1 week and then never came back.
Yeah, because that was...
That weird... there was a weird girl who organized it.
Oh, I don't even remember who the weird girl was.
She was in your level one class.
I only remember Jane Warden from my level one class.
Yeah.
We don't have the same names. What level was that after?
That was in between level one and two.
Oh, right. It was an in-between. Right. Yeah. Because I had met my husband the week after I started improv.
So you guys were not super tight at the time of Joe Ross Tribe being formed.
No, but we got put on Joe Ross Tribe and almost pretty immediately became like attached at the hip.
Yeah.
And then what's happened is like that was about a year into it. And then what's happened is like a 9-year relationship where 7/8 of the time we're insanely close, and then 1/8 of the time we're really mad at each other.
Let's talk about the first Joe Ross Tribe show, because I was there for that, and you guys, it was your first team, and I think almost everybody on it was their first team. Not quite everybody, like Curtis was on it, and Tom it was Schmid, not his first team.
Tom Schmid was not his first team, and Bernie and Tamara was not their first team.
No. So you were completely wrong.
I was completely wrong on that. But they were relatively new people. There was no like big
people,
guns on that
Shannon,
team.
Rhea. Or was Rhea?
No, Rhea was an optimist.
Oh, yeah, Rhea was only an optimist.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, I'm forgetting. Oof, crazy.
But your first show, like, you guys were super psyched the way like everybody is psyched when they're put on their team the first time. I remember the music kicked in and Gethard, you came out, went right to the front of the stage and pumped your fist in the air and stuck your tongue out and like pumped it up a couple of times, and the crowd like went bananas. And you look baby-faced now. You look like you were like 11 years old in this memory I have of you coming to the front of the stage.
I see pictures of myself then, and I'm always wearing a blue button-down shirt and khakis, and I always have on all-white sneakers, and I weigh like 130 pounds, no joke.
Yeah.
And I always have the worst haircut. When I was in college, I looked like I was always about to die.
And that was around the time you started dyeing your hair, right?
Well,
that was a little bit after?
I dyed my hair off and on throughout high school and college because I thought I was a punk rocker.
But just dyed it like
I would just
red.
Dye it more red. I would dye it a deeper red.
So it was like orange.
But all it did was make me look more hideously pale.
That first like, Joe Ross Tribe... Oh, sorry, Shannon.
No, I was going to say it was like carrot top red.
I remember the first Joe Ross Tribe show. We did a scene where we were doing jump rope, like double dutch, over Shannon O'Neill's 8-foot-long clit.
I think the way
it
started...
Was labia. Okay. Wasn't, or maybe it was my clitoris. You're right.
I don't know how female genitalia works, so it's
it
all
was
like,
yeah, it
same
was either
shit to me.
I thought it was double dutch. No, it might have been my clitoris.
No, double dutch. You're right.
We were double dutching, so maybe it was my. I think it was my.
It's a lot more realistic to assume it was your labia.
It's my pussy lips.
First show out the gate.
Yeah.
Pussy
well, this is one of those. This is one of the shows where the team is so hyper. There was like just tons of screaming and physical commitment. And everybody was like bouncing off the walls. Like that's sort of a type of new team first show.
That was like my thing too, though. Was like bouncing, like even on the back line.
Yeah, you were very jittery on the back line.
I was always mocked, sort of like both applauded and mocked for like bouncing around on the back wall.
Yeah, it's either wow, that guy's into it, he's committed, or it's like
his
why won't that dude
loose.
Chill out and just.
Yeah. Then in 2002, I went on antidepressants, and that immediately stopped. It was pure like anxiety and depression coming out in physical form. Why did everyone get quiet?
I just got bored with the story.
I'm in a closet.
So it was Joe Ross Tribe. How long you guys?
It was 9 months. It was May. It was May 2001.
That team exploded.
January 2nd or 3rd
no,
of 2002.
Yeah,
our team was,
like
our team was broken up,
I think
and then
December,
we were assigned
we were up and reassigned to Optimist because I was in Chicago on an improv sabbatical when I got the call, and that was over Christmas break from Rutgers. Anyway, this is the least interesting
improv sabbatical.
I used to drive to Chicago and go watch improv.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm crazy. When I would have winter break from college, and I think I did it 2 or 3 times where I would just drive to Chicago and watch. I was obsessed.
So this would be like in 2000 or something, or
yeah, that was like 2001.
Yeah.
2002, I think, yeah.
Nuts. What a nerd. Yeah. That team was crazy. Joe Ross Tribe was nuts. It was like a bunch of either new people and sort of crazy people. Curtis Gwynn in his crazy phase.
Yes.
I don't mind saying that.
Yeah, I would say Joe Ross Tribe, the big thing was, it was like, we were just like crazy energy.
Yeah.
And so I think people loved our shows because it was like, there was so much energy behind it. But it's one of those things where even, I think, back then, I confused it where I think, this is going into like what is good improv. I think people confuse energy and good improv.
Yeah, there was no precision.
No, we did not do very good improv. No. Our improv was pretty terrible.
We were broken up. One of the members of the committee, it was the committee at that time.
Yeah.
The member who called us told me, at least, you are by far the most talented team we've had to break up this quick. Because all we would do was, like, scream and yell. And then off stage, we'd always be, like, not fighting, but just, like, tense.
9 months is fast for back then.
Yeah, dude, that was really bad. We were a good team, but it just wasn't going to work. But then we wound up on Optimist, and that was when
Optimist was a super group. Like, it was one of the early super groups. Like, Pound was a super group. Mother, Respecto, certainly. The Swarm was the king of them. But then Optimist arrived. I wouldn't say forgotten. You were sort of like the first. I love these machines that are firing up. You were sort of, in that time, it felt like a second generation supergroup.
Yeah.
Like those other guys were already like established and off and running.
Yes, we were a really good team, and I don't feel bad saying that. That was when I mean, you want to know when I knew I was good? It was when I got a call that was like, you're on a team with Brian Husky and Rob Corddry, who was only on for one show, but.
Yeah. Who else was on that team originally? That lineup changed a lot, but who was the original lineup?
Me, Shannon, Rhea Dates, McKeel, Schmid, Husky, Seth, Rob.
Yeah, so it's Dave McKeel.
Right.
That's Tom Schmidt, Rob Corddry.
Yeah.
Brian Husky.
Seth Morris.
Seth Morris. Myself, Shannon O'Neill, Rhea Dates. And Jack McBrayer was added two or three months after we started.
I had actually seen him on one of my improv sabbaticals. We got an email from Kevin Mulaney, the AD at that time, that was like, because Corddry had to split for The Daily Show.
Corddry hadn't officially left yet. We were like technically a 9-person Herald team. Because Corddry, I think, was still holding on. Like,
he did like one show after that first show. He came back and did like one other one.
No, he did one rehearsal. He did one show. And then he did like
a walk on
in an opening and left. He like came to pick something up. Heard that we were on, came out, did like a quick little thing in our organic opening, and then he went out back into his car and drove away.
But Mulaney emailed me and was like, there's this guy, McBrayer, coming from Chicago. You should pick him up if you want. Talk with your team about it. And I had just been out there, and I'd seen him do a whole show where he just played a waiter and never said anything and killed. And I was like, yes, we should get this guy. And,
yeah.
We went with it. So, yeah, McBrayer was at the
McBrayer's impact in the theater was big. Like, he showed up, and instantly, everything he did, everybody fell over laughing.
Yes.
I mean, really good improviser, very nice dude, but also just had that, like, weird power over the room.
And he looked out for me a lot, too.
Yeah.
So that was big in my development.
You guys were already a hot team, and then adding McBrayer was, like, unfair. You went on one of the first huge cage match runs. Like, it was, like, 16 weeks or something?
We won 14 cage matches in a row, but that was in an era where it was all Harold teams.
So there was no easy indie teams. Some of the Harold teams
did. No, The Office beat us.
Well, yeah, is that bad to say?
Right. The indie teams came up, like, once in a blue moon, and The Office, which was Anthony King and Charlie Todd.
Yeah.
A team that I coached overthrew me.
Ruben, those guys are all, they're on Ruben Williams, right?
Ruben Williams, is that like an under St. Mark's team?
Well, The Office was this really good indie team, and Anthony and Charlie came off that, and everybody was like, these guys are going to wind up at the top, and they almost did.
They were. Well, The Office was an amazing team, though. Like, yes. I think Anthony was in level 2 when that team started.
That was my first, because I've always taken pride in being a good coach, and that was like my first guys that I coached. That was like my first team.
Yeah.
That was like, oh, those lunatics.
Yeah. That was a time when indie teams really did not get in a cage match too often, and The Office, like, they did pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah. But let's talk about Optimist a little bit more. I want to talk. Here's what I want to cover in Optimist. Organic openings, because the organic opening was awesome. I think the Shoves have done it well. Optimist International did it well. A couple teams have really rocked it for an extended period of time, and that's one of them.
I'm going to go ahead and say this, man. We did it the best, and nobody's done it as good since. Nobody has.
The Shoves did it pretty well.
Well, the Shoves did all that thematic stuff.
Oh, yeah, Fwan. Oh, yeah. Jesus. Fwan is its own animal. No one did what Fwan did.
Thing. Yeah. I know. Yeah, yeah, totally. We were doing completely different heroes.
Because, like, there would be a whole set piece at the beginning you wouldn't revisit, and Fwan, it was the whole show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No one has done what Fwan has done.
I don't think Fwan would have happened if you and I hadn't been through Optimist. There's no way.
Definitely not.
You need someone who has seen it work to convince everybody else, like, this feels stupid right now, but this is going to be awesome.
Yeah.
No, yeah, those were pretty awesome organics that we did.
So, okay, why did they work?
It was like, I think, looking back, and I mean, this was also, 8 years ago, so
sure.
It's hard to remember.
All qualifications of memory and being on the inside apply, but why do you think it worked?
To me, I think it was like, A, 110% commitment, every single one. B, a lot of, like, physicality, but not just for the sake of doing it. Like, physicality that was almost a reflection of listening. And also, like, there was no ego as far as being funny. I remember that team having like the openings having like a lot of big moments where we just trusted that they would be funny. But I think the Achilles heel of organic openings, by and large, is that people feel insecure about the fact that they're weird and not funny. But I don't think we ever, I think we knew we were 8 funny people and it was going to be funny. So we were just allowing it to be what it wanted to be, and it led to some really cool things.
I think it's really hard to be decisive in them when you're new at them. I remember like just having it mean anything, but yet not totally descend into just thinking and saying things is like the biggest challenge of doing them.
Yeah, we were very good at when you saw someone make a move organically and all of us supporting it in a way that you could never tell who started it. Yeah. Like you could never tell who started the transition. Like we knew, but like the audience, I don't think would ever be like, wait, who, that just like happened? Like it's like they all figured that out, but it was just like, we jumped on it and supported it so fast.
It also helps to have like Brian Husky just could be awesomely funny in the middle of it just for a moment, well, yeah, and just you explode with laughter and get you energy to keep going or something, you know. Yeah. I'm picking him.
It's easy to say like we weren't worried about being funny, but it makes it a lot easier when you have Seth Meyers, Brian Husky, and Jack McBrayer. Yeah. You know, that makes it a lot easier to not worry about if it's going to be funny or not.
Didn't you guys do a Harold in the Dark during your cage match run? There was a time you guys were mixing it up a lot. That was your second cage match run when we moved to the new theater.
Yeah.
Right? Or did that cage match run cross the theater?
I think that might have been a different lineup.
I was still there. There was someone we were trying to beat. It might have been the Swarm. We might have been up against someone or Mother. Oh, it might have been Mother. Wasn't Mother the team that always would beat us?
Yes.
Mother killed in
cage
match.
We had like a feud. We had a sort of like feud with Mother.
My husband hates Mother because they beat us in cage match.
But Husky and Seth and Manzoukas and Easton, those guys were all really good friends. Yeah. So it was like this playful thing. But we would kill everybody. And I don't know. Did we beat them? I think they ended our run a couple times.
Yeah, this was at the new theater. I feel like Terry Jin was on the team by then.
Yeah. Whatever it was, we had this thing with Mother, and we did it Harold in the Dark, unannounced, to try to take them down. And I think it worked.
Yeah, I remember it being really fun.
Yeah, you guys won that. I didn't see it, but I remember hearing about that run. Optimus, huge team. Like, they lasted a long time, and they were... it was one of the lineup changed a lot by the end. And by the end, it wasn't as strong a team as when it started, just the chemistry got messed with. But it was just because you guys had been such giants, I think nobody could imagine Optimus going away. This water is happening like every 10 minutes. It's like somebody is taking a piss behind us as we do this.
Yeah, there's only two. I think there's only myself and Rhea Dates were the only two original members left by the end of Optimus.
That happens. You'll see big teams in Harold Knight who are just awesome, and they kind of go past their sell-by date sometimes.
Well,
but it's
messed
like
that up,
you're sentimentally attached to it. You're like...
I'll talk you about like, it. I don't care.
I think by the end, I was on the team, but I was like, this team's garbage.
Yeah.
Just because it wasn't
same thing
like
happened
yet.
To Arsenal.
All great people.
Arsenal was a great team for a long, long
another
time.
Another team I was on that became garbage.
But after, I'm the one that killed Arsenal.
Yeah.
I was on it in the end. I mean, that was still like a pleasant team and okay, but like some teams are so great, you can't bear to let them go, I think, as a community. It's like,
and
Optimus.
That's a tough thing, You have all like 8 great people, but then sometimes you just don't work well together.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. So what happened from there? Is this when
Van Buren? Well, I left.
When did Van Buren?
I left Optimist, and then Van Buren happened. And Van Buren was like, I feel like I've always had this interesting thing where like, I was always like Optimist, I was like the junior guy.
Yeah.
And Van Buren, I was like the senior.
Right.
Like
right.
I always have straddled that line.
Yeah.
But Van Buren happened, and that was a really fun team. That was with Eric Scott and John Reynolds, who went on to I think be part of.
Some Dark Champions?
Team.
They were
from this really great indie group called
Dark
Champions.
Dark Champions was great.
So awesome.
I remember Dark Champions very
and then
well.
A pretty
then
good
Reynolds
UCB
went
team.
Where? He went to some UCB team.
Ruben Williams.
Oh, that's what it was. That's right. Wow.
Yeah.
How long did those guys last?
They're still around.
Oh, really? When did they
But it was cool because you used to go and be able to be like, oh, yeah, let's go watch those guys from Dark Champions, you know, as part of this other group. But yeah, I did Van Buren, and that was really nice, and then Arsenal after that.
My first coaching gig was coaching you and Van Buren. John Reynolds asked me – oh, no, right before you started. John Reynolds asked me to coach Van Buren. I'd never coached anybody.
All right.
I coached the Herald team. And then you were, like, at the next rehearsal. Like, oh, we got Gethard. He's back, and he's on this team. It's weird.
Yeah, that happened. I coached Van Buren and then joined the team, and then I coached Arsenal and then joined the team.
That's right.
Yep.
What else are we gonna talk? What else we go here?
Talk about those Arsenal shows.
What do you? Oh yeah, yeah. About? Arsenal, another great team you're on.
Your
so how did that?
Frashanti usually like write shit down. And
he keeps the whole thing together. To be honest, I'm the color commentator. This is it's tough. When did Arsenal happen after Optimist, obviously? Oh, so Van Buren, then Arsenal?
Yeah, Arsenal was like 2005. And those were the shows with me and Peter Gwynn where he would terrorize me on stage and everybody loved them and I was kind of sad.
Yeah, right. There was like a big thing, but he would always steal your glasses. A lot of the show was, not a lot of the show, but a frequent thing that would happen in the shows would be Peter Gwynn fucking with Chris Gethard.
Yeah.
Right.
Not in character.
No, totally out in the open.
But Peter Gwynn was someone that you looked up to. You would go to Chicago.
Yeah, he was my guy. When I would go.
You'd see him eating in a diner and you'd sit in your car and watch him eat, right?
I don't know if I ever did that. Did I do that? I wouldn't be surprised if I told Shannon. Like, if in 2004 I was like, I saw this fucking guy. No, but he was my favorite Chicago improviser. I saw him in Chicago with Baby Wants Candy. Loved him. And then he would come in for the marathons. And I would tell everybody, you got to watch this guy. So smart, so funny. And he is. And then I wound up on a team with him where he repaid me by publicly humiliating me like 5 or 6 times in front of an
although
entire
to
community.
Huge effect, the crowd would go bananas. Like Arsenal shows were explosive.
Dude, it was hilarious because I'd go read the IRC and I'd be kind of down, but then I'd see. I remember the best one. All these IRC comments on the shows where people were like, "Those were like amazing shows." And I remember one where someone was like, "Gethard bleeds so well," and I was like, "Oh."
The IRC is the ImprovResourceCenter.com. For anyone listening that doesn't know what that is,
yeah.
Full of trolls now, though.
Yeah.
No,
it's okay.
Yeah.
So those were good shows. Sunshine Gang, that was in when we didn't have a theater, that was weirdly like...
Is that when that started?
We didn't have a theater when the Sunshine Gang started.
Yeah. I didn't know that.
We kind of like weirdly became the anchor of the community in the dark time.
During the dark ages before the Renaissance of 26th Street. So what was the Sunshine Gang? Who started that?
Billy Merritt started a group. He just came up to me and Brian Husky and Chad Carter, and he was like, I want to do a show. It was a very Billy Merritt idea. He's like, I want to do a show. It's set in the Great Depression. And we were all like, all right, Billy, whenever. And it was kind of – Billy would always have ideas like that, you know, like all these like off-the-wall ideas. And then he was like, yeah, I booked us a night at the Irish Repertory Theater. And we were like, you really did it? And he's like, sure. So we all dressed up like it was the 1930s and did this show, and it was just super bizarre. But, you know, those four guys, it was really fun, and we actually wound up putting it together like – it was a really good improv show. We just happened to... It kind of makes me mad. Most people these days have probably only seen that in the marathon.
Yeah.
It's like a 15-minute fuck-around slot. But that show was actually really probably the thing that made me get better. Better than, like, faster than any other show I ever did.
Why?
Because I think, like, first of all, you're up there in, like, overalls and no shoes pretending it's the 30s. So you have to just commit. If you don't commit 1,000%, you're just going to feel like an asshole. And it was also, like... just challenged you to be smart. You know, you had to have like a real knowledge of history that wasn't going to be off-putting to an audience, and we moved fast, and it was just a show that was so weird, but the players, especially those other three guys at that time, were so powerful on stage that it was just like, work hard. I mean, did you ever see it? You
know, I saw a bunch of shows. I mean, you never know what it's like on the inside.
I would probably say some of my favorite shows that I've ever done are probably Sunshine Gang shows.
Maybe it's also because it was a small group. Like, you'd probably, until that time, it always been like 8-person groups, you know, 7-person groups. Yeah. You get to like a 3 or 4-person thing, it's different. You're more a part of it. It's like a lot more on you, the whole show. It's exciting. Maybe that was part of it too.
Yeah, maybe, Will.
So maybe the group wasn't so great. That's what I'm saying. Shannon, you got to take over. This roof is caving in on me. I got to get rid of this green screen.
Let's talk about Vicious Liquid.
Oh, that was a 2-person sketch show that Shannon and I tried to write, and it went so poorly that we didn't talk for like a year.
This is correct.
Really?
We wrote a spank.
Hated me at the end of that show.
No, I didn't hate him. I think we both were like, let's...
Our hearts were broken.
Our hearts. We broke each other's hearts.
Our best friends' hearts were broken.
I think we broke each other's hearts.
And we weren't really friends again until Fwand, right? I mean, friendly, but not like we were.
No, it took a while.
Shannon and I were pretty cold on each other.
I want to say it was like 9 months. It wasn't like a full year.
Felt so much longer.
Yeah. But no, we wrote a sketch show together. Zach Woods was in it. He played a tree. Tarek Davis was in it. He played a bear. And it was kind of like a 2 parallel worlds that kind of like collided.
Weird. It was really bizarre.
Essentially, this is what happens. A truck carrying zoo animals overturns, and these animals are now free, and they don't know what to do with their lives. And then while that's going on, there's a guy and a girl that like each other, both kind of nerdy.
Here was the problem.
you wrote a show about animals, and I wrote a show about a girl who didn't like a guy. And instead of just choosing one, we tried to do both.
Essentially.
Mine had all these Smith songs playing in the background the whole time, and then it would cut back to these animals. Everybody liked the animals more. We should have just done a show about animals. What we really wanted to do was get together and put together a show. Our whole plan was to do, like, let's do just everything weird and bizarre and fucked up. And we kind of basically, instead of just ever having a conversation that was
we
just fought and fought and fought. But now I look at it and I'm like, what you're doing with Prison Freaks and what I'm doing with the Gethard Show is like the type of stuff we wanted to be doing anyway. But it took, we like delayed it by 6 years.
I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. But I learned so much. Even though Gethard and I literally conversations where I'm screaming and then crying. Then Gethard's yelling at me and I'm crying and screaming.
I remember
it was like
being
terrible.
Like, why are you treating me like this? We're friends, having that conversation. We're friends. Why are you treating me like this? Yeah.
It was pretty, but now, we're fine, guys.
Yeah, because I remember one thing where I was living with my parents in New Jersey and we had a gigantic prop and you were keeping it in your apartment and you were like, why can't you fucking keep that in your parents' backyard? And I was... a big pallet, a big wooden pallet.
That
and
was you making the pallet.
No, I made you make it. That was also the problem. I got really super lazy and you like ruled me with an iron fist. You were like, get there, do this. I also remember you made me go to a Toys R Us and buy props, and I spent like $180 on props, and I was like 20. I didn't have $180. I was like 21 years old. I spent so much money on like, that fucking show is crazy. Gorilla Mask? What did I buy? Dude, I walked out of a Toys R Us when I was 21
years old. You had a remote control car.
A remote control car, a football, a children's pool, a gorilla mask and a giraffe mask and a bear mask.
No, I had the giraffe mask already.
Oh, you got the giraffe mask.
You got the bear mask.
I had to buy a whole bunch of brown felt to make a Zach Woods-sized tree costume.
How many times did the show play? I think I made that.
We did it once, we didn't talk for 9 months.
Yeah. I made the tree costume. We may have gone and bought some stuff together.
I think I bought a bunch of shit.
Yeah, but I made the tree costume.
All I know
costume.
Is I remember spending... so much.
We probably spent over $300 on it, I think.
To do a show once. We spent $300 to momentarily kill a great friendship.
Yeah. Maybe we should do a stage reading of it if I can find the script.
You probably would still have it. I don't have it.
Let's go on to teaching and coaching. You've coached a lot of new Herald team. Let's talk about coaching first.
Yes.
You coached a lot of you've been a lot of Herald team's first or long-time coaches. You were Fwan's long-time first and long-time coach. You coached Ragnarok for a long time.
Yeah, for a year.
You
Bastion.
Bastion for a long time. Dillinger for a long time.
Oh yeah, Dillinger.
Van Buren and Arsenal, you both coached in the early days.
Yeah.
And you coached
the opera. I just coached I had to stop because of Big Lake, but I was.
You were opera's first coach.
Yeah. I would say
Mailer Demon.
Oh, Mailer Demon. I coached a bunch. I would say coaching improv is one of the only things in my life I've been naturally good at.
All right, so what's important to you when you're a coach? I'll give you some hypotheticals.
Sure.
New team, what's important to you when you start coaching them? First rehearsals,
Herald
team, yeah.
I would say new Herald team. The first thing I always tell them is, like, it's so easy to destroy a team, you know what I mean? And the ways to do it are to talk shit about each other and to split into cliques and to, like, I basically am like, if I ever catch you at McManus talking with some guy you had level four with about how this or that person is ruining your team or giving you a hard time, like, that's nobody's business. It's family business. And if you're not ready to treat this like family business, you shouldn't have made this team. You know what I mean? So to me, that's, as far as coaching goes, you know, starting with when I coached indie groups up till when I worked with Dillinger, which was the first Herald team I worked with and had a lot of fun and great success with, to me, it's always been, part of it is like you fought to get there. It's a small number of people, and you have to treat it like it has to be like behind closed doors family stuff. You know what I mean? Like, Fwan was doing great shows, but Shannon can vouch, like, some of the discussions you guys would have behind closed doors were not. They were tense. You know what I mean? Any team, it's going to have tension. It's going to have debates over how things should go and what's the best way to do it. And I feel like a coach's job is to sort of be like there, kind of making sure those things aren't stifled up and unaddressed, but also making sure they don't become cancerous. I think my experience on Joel Ross Tribe was a situation that became kind of cancerous. We wound up in one of those things where there were cliques. Yeah. Shannon and I were one of the cliques. You know what I mean? So kind of seeing how that went and having been on, I've been on a bunch of teams that fell apart, you know? So I feel like I'm able to speak from experience and say, like, let's get to work. We'll figure out what we need to work on. But the first thing we need to do is everybody basically needs to, you know, become a company man and dedicate themselves to this completely.
What's the first warm-up you have him do?
I usually, what's the first warm-up I have new teams do? I mean, I guess a lot of it, I've had the luxury of having taught most of the people in classes, by and large, for the last few teams I've worked on, so a lot of times I'll build it off of that. Usually I like to do stuff that's like focus-based, like stuff that, you know, build patterns together and keep them in the air, stuff that it's like you cannot do this if anybody shifts focus away from the team, you know, stuff that's about like all eight people have to be focused and participating in this for it to live.
How do you do, what sort of exercises do you like to do? What sort of points? I mean, you kind of answered this in your general philosophical statement. What sort of things are you having them on their feet doing in like the first couple months?
Well, you know, one of the luxuries of coaching versus teaching is you get to design it based on what's going on. So I would say, like, you know, for Ragnarok, that was super different than what it was for the opera or
for. Can you say, for example, like, what did you have Ragnarok do?
That was a while. What did we work on with? Oh, Ragnarok. I remember with them, one of the real interesting things with working with them was in, we do so, a lot of, like, most of the stuff I do with all the groups is let's do group-driven stuff. That's what I think I'm good with, is, like, you've got these eight pieces, and how does that fit together in a group, and what exercises can we do that will support that group? So with Ragnarok, you had all these people who were, like, kind of, like, smart, laid-back sweethearts. You know what I mean? So it's, like, doing a lot of stuff that's, like, how can we get to a point where that's showing up in the shows? And in rehearsals, they would find a lot of stuff like that. Whereas with Fwand, that was one of the best experiences I had coaching, and probably, you know, with Shannon here, we could talk about that the most as an example, where it was like, I feel like we had so many discussions that were like, all right, we've got like six maniacs, and then we got Kevin and Dominic, who are two of the best straight men. Like, how do we make that work? You know what I mean? Like, six.
And you'd actually say that out loud in front of everybody?
We would say shit like that all the time. Yeah.
We would call each other out all the time.
Yeah.
Sean Hart's late, Gabrus will not let it go.
Yeah.
We would always call each other out on our bullshit, and I think that's why we worked, because we weren't passive aggressive, we were just aggressive in the present.
Yeah, and I think that's part of why I clicked with you guys. I remember when you started all the organic stuff, it was after I kind of like made fun of you giving you notes, right? It was like, stop doing the fucking invocation. Like, stop being.
Well, yeah, we only did that for like two shows.
Mailer Demon was a team that had done the invocation for a long time to great success. And then a couple people left and you guys became Fwan and you kept doing the invocation briefly. And that's when you started talking shit.
I remember saying something. It was like, you guys need to just figure out something that's super hard to do and you're all crazy, so make it crazy, but stop doing what worked for Mailer Demon. It's going to be too easy, you know?
Yeah.
And then
we agreed.
And then it became these, like, a year of rehearsals that was just, like, everybody making fun of each other, talking shit. It was really fun. It was the best.
And I think one of the biggest lessons I took from, well, worked on Mailer Demon too, but I think in Fwand, when it was, we were taking on this bigger monster of doing this organic stuff, was everyone has to be on board.
Yeah.
If you're, and there's a, and you know, it made sense. I think there's a couple people that were like, I don't know about this. But then once, I think Gethard even said it, was like, if you are not sure about this, how about this? Let me see you try it. And then once those people that were not into it as much actually tried it, it started to work. So it's like, if you hate something, like, don't hate it until you actually try it to learn that you hate it.
Yeah, that's, as far as coaching and teaching, especially after I took, since I've come back to teaching, I think my big thing has been, like, you got the playbook, which is what we teach in the curriculum. You know, like, that's the skills you need to know. And if you can't get those, you're not going to be good at this. But once you're good at that, then it's up to you to decide what you can do with it as an individual. And when you wind up with a group, how does the group utilize those rules? And that's something I think I've learned pretty big from working with Fwand, you know?
Now, you also like to, don't you like to promote rivalries with your groups? Or don't you kind of like to antagonistically say, hey, man, people think you do this. Are you going to show them differently?
Yeah, I think I once told Fwand that I was lying. I don't know if I've told anyone that.
I know what you...
I told you guys that people were saying you weren't smart enough to do what you were trying to do.
You told us Anthony King said we're not smart enough to do what we're doing.
I'm pretty sure Anthony never said that. I'll have to ask him. I think I told you guys that I got an email from Anthony King that was like, maybe you guys shouldn't do this. You're not smart enough. But here's another thing about Fwand. They weren't fucking scared, man. That's the thing that kills me. If there's any improv students listening to this right now, the main thing that kills me is it's like, everyone convinces themselves that this is harder and scarier than it has to be. And then what happens is people like trip up on the way to doing things that are actually easy. You know, so Flond, the thing everybody forgets about them is that their first few shows of trying that organic stuff were really sort of embarrassing.
Very rough shows,
embarrassingly
yeah.
bad. For players that good to do shows that bad.
Having just been a team that was dominant.
Yeah, Mailer Demon was, like, so cocky they were making newsletters, you know? Like, handing
Anchors Away newsletters?
Yeah. So Flan, like, really shit the bed pretty hard their first two or three shows doing it, to the point where I wanted to quit, but Shannon and Kevin Hines were both like, fuck that, and led the charge back in the other direction. I remember Kevin in particular was like, no, we're not quitting on it. But those guys were not scared. That's another thing. Like, I get a lot of, since I'm kind of known for doing like this crazy stuff in classes, and I feel like I'm pretty good about bringing it out of people. Sometimes people ask me, like, how do you do that? And the main thing is, like, stop being scared. Like, what's the worst that happens? Your improv show is like a little worse than it would have been if you just made jokes, you know? Yeah.
How about your recent classes? So you taught for a long time, a lot of classes. You used to run the school.
Yeah.
You wrote the curriculum,
yes.
which was then rewritten and expanded by Joe.
Yes.
But still incorporates a lot of what you wrote. And before you, Mulaney had written a version that you used to go off, that you used to start. And you ran the school, you taught a lot.
Yes.
A lot of the levels.
I taught almost every level 3 class for like almost a year, I think.
Yeah. And then you kind of burnt out on that and took a break.
Yes. I had a lot of career anxiety, and my therapist said I needed to stop teaching. My shrink, it was great advice. She was like,
Your mood definitely improved. We were on the Stepfather together when that happened. And
I was having panic attacks. I was crying in the green room before Stepfather shows.
This is absolutely true.
Shannon feels awkward that I'm recording it, but I'm totally happy to own it.
I'm over here
would
laughing.
Cry, would have panic attacks, breakdowns.
This is for real true, and I'll say this. Ever since I've known you, and I've known you since you got here.
Since I was 19 years old.
Yeah. Have always said, oh, I got a lot of anger issues. I got a lot of sadness and stuff like that. But what I have always seen contradicting that is this awesome success you've had in the community, embraced pretty early, teacher saying this guy's good. Why don't you substitute in for Delaney and Piledriver? Why don't you go do these? Like, very early on kind of flagged as this guy might be good to he is very good. And I was like, well, that guy has confidence. He's nothing but success in the whole time I've known him. Then we got on Stepfathers, and I was like, oh, no, this guy has sometimes
problems.
For real anger issues
problems.
That get the better of him and are helpless.
I feel like, you know, I wouldn't be successful on any level if I wasn't driven by, like, immense fear and sadness. It's true.
You took that break in teaching. It definitely – your mood improved. You needed to get – it was a burden to you for whatever reason,
yes.
and it was good for you to let
it
go.
The good thing is, you know – I had been teaching on the curriculum, and when I came back, you were nice enough to let me just design my own classes, and they
right.
became these sort of crazy classes. And I was lucky enough where the first class back had...
You had a stacked class.
Yeah, it had a lot of people who are doing great now, like Don Finelli, Michael Caine, Noah Forman, Jesse Lee, Catherine Mudon, a lot of people who I'm still very close with today. So I kind of like was blessed to hit the ground running with a bunch of people who were hungry to be crazy. All those people I just named are crazy people, and... It really brought me back to life as a teacher, and I feel really good about the stuff I've done since I've been back.
May I ask you a semi-antagonistic question,
yes.
just meant for discussion?
Sure.
Do you think sometimes this kind of like go crazy, get hyper stuff can lean to be just like empty energy again? Just sort of like, oh, it's a great
yeah.
sounding idea. How does it actually apply to doing a good improv show?
Well, that I feel like with a lot of the classes, with the classes I taught where I would encourage them specifically, it was 1 week out of every class where I would have them, I would say, just whatever happens, follow it. So that's the thing. A lot of it is like loud and rampaging around with these things that my classes have become known for, but I would stand by them in the sense of, A, I try to frame it as far as the whole thing is based around saying yes. Like if someone does something and you say yes to it and it gets out of control, are you going to regulate it or are you going to keep saying yes to it? So that's a big part of it, is like resisting that urge to censor ourselves. One thing I've noticed is that, you know, as we all know, I stand by the UCB system. It's the best. It clearly works. The dark side of it is that it becomes mathematical in some people's minds. So people just get to the end of the equation and then want to stop it from going anywhere else. There's this real side of students, I think, and people on stage where it's an effort to control things, control what's happening. Don't let it get out of the box. But really, you never remember the shows that stay at that level, you know? So it was a sort of effort to point out, like, if you keep saying yes and you always resist that urge that it's too big, it's too much, you will get to something you'll never forget. And I would say there's a lot of people in my classes who would say that when we would do that day, that would oftentimes involve leaving the room and leaving the training center, and then got a lot of the other teachers mad at me. Eric Tenoy gets mad at me every time I do it. But ask those students what it was like the week afterwards when we try to do Harold's again. There's some really cool shit where it's like, if you are willing, the whole reason any of us want to do this is because we want to get on stage when there's nothing defined and then let it happen, but we then play by the rules. It kind of, to me, contradicts the mentality of anyone who would be weird enough to want to do this and not sketch comedy or stand-up comedy. So I remember one Harold that happened in a class, the Statesman Harold, which Corey Brown was in, Keith Bethea was in it, Dan Klein from
the acapella group?
Yes, where they, the suggestion was Pennsylvania, and they just sang a song about Pennsylvania. And it looked like it was the opening. It was like, we all went down to Pennsylvania, did a little line with Pennsylvania, did a little with Pennsylvania. And they all filled in a different specific. And I think Klein had something like, gonna find my baby in Pennsylvania. And then they stopped, and one of them stepped out and was like, thank you, we're the Statesmen. Can we have another state? And then someone was like, Wisconsin. And they just went, we all went down to Wisconsin, and just echoed it. And it ended with Klein going, and went down to find my baby in Wisconsin. I think it was Klein. And they did that for half an hour, just state by state. And it, like, got a huge laugh up top when people realized they were going to do it, and then it went into that sort of lull when people were like, oh, they're really just going to do that. And then when it was like, oh my god, they're actually really just going to do that. But if, you know, if any of them gave into that part of their brains that was like, now we need to cut away from this and have a group game to break it up, which is the traditional rule, it wouldn't have been a good thing. You know, it would not have been a good show. So I do think that crazy stuff, it has some meat to its bones. I also feel like I'm sort of responsible for a lot of, if I may, bullshit improv, where people just do that shit to do it because it sounds and looks like it, but you know more than anybody, I put an insane amount of thought into classes. I, like, part of why I can't teach them that often is because I refuse to not live and die for them, you know,
right,
so
right.
It makes it too hard on me.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of people who maybe are teaching that stuff to fill up time, maybe. I don't know what they're doing. I don't know.
Well, I don't know either. You're not saying that about me, are you?
No, I'm not talking shit about anybody in general. I'm just
I know.
I think a lot of coaches or whatever are doing it as an exercise, but it's not really an exercise so much as a philosophy that I strongly, strongly believe in. So I don't know. I feel like I'm talking bad about other people now.
No. You're answering my question. I mean,
whose name are you writing on that paper?
Yeah, what it?
Oh, name, what's that name? You're writing
why are you showing us a name?
Later.
Well, you're showing it right. Oh my God, that person! Wow. Yep, you're right. That person's bad.
But I always think
Ruben
about.
Williams.
I always think about, and here's another thing. So much of my teaching after that break goes back to Fwan because of the stuff we did together. Because I coached you guys for almost like a year when you were doing that shit. But I remember one show they did, where I forget who it was. Someone just stepped out and froze in place, and then everybody saw it and just froze. And it was just like, he froze, we're going to froze. What is that? That's just yes. You know what I mean? That's just, I agree, we'll freeze. And the crowd starts giggling, and then it goes silent. And at that point, traditional thinking would say, like, we better define what this is and justify where we're just standing here. But those guys all had the balls to just go, let's just stand here and not do or say anything. And it went on, and it was, like, silent in the theater for a long time. And then these giggles started building. And when one person started giggling, everybody started giggling. It built into this big applause. And then I think it was Gabrus finally went, cool, he's gone. And then you guys broke back to the back line. And it was, like, honestly, like a 90-second
Oh, I remember that. I remember that show.
It was, like...
That was, like, a group game, I think, right?
It was a group game. But it was, like, all that was is, like, the simplest thing in the world. Just, like, you did that. I'm going to agree with it. I don't know what you're going for. But the first thing that you're going to know is that I don't even need to know what you're doing to support
it. Big listening
it.
Is part of this, though. Fwan was great listeners. Like, you remember the moves, but everyone's got their eyes on each other the whole time in that group, and in any group that can do that. Like, any slight thing is noticed.
Yes. But I think that's part of what I enjoy as a coach and teacher, and part of what I'm good at is, like, I'm like, my whole thing is, like, no one else looks like an asshole. Like, you're not allowed. Like, if someone else is trying something, I don't know if I should I say specifics from teams that exist now?
I think you should.
Was it a show?
It was a show on Harold Night.
Yeah.
I remember in the opera show, it might have been their first show, they were doing a pattern game, and at one point Elena spun in a circle, and no one else did. Yeah. And I'm like, I don't know what she was going for, and you don't either, but you don't get to operate from the part of you that's scared of not knowing. Yeah. Like, right now, we're getting off stage, and I would bet Elena feels like a fucking asshole for trying something cool, and all seven of the other people don't look like assholes, but you know you're the assholes. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. You protected yourself because you were scared you didn't know what was going on, and someone else looked like an asshole because you were the asshole who was scared, you know? Yeah. So to me, that's part of, like, coaching and teaching, especially coaching to me, is like, if you're scared, that's protecting yourself. You're being an asshole. You're betraying the idea that you take care of the other person.
Right.
Opera had a kick-ass show 2 weeks ago. You'll be glad to hear.
Yeah, man. I think they're great. I think they're awesome. So many of my favorites are on that.
Yeah, team. Yeah. We don't have too much more time. There's a lot more I wish we could talk about.
Is this like what these usually are?
This is what happens. And everyone makes that comment at some point in it.
Yeah.
Like, right in the middle of talking to Zach, he was like, is this right? Am I this, that, or the other?
Cool. This is more interesting than Zach's, right?
Let's say yes. I mean, the guy played jazz trumpet. He had some fascinating anecdotes.
Oh, I could do anecdotes. You want to do war anecdotes? I'll do war anecdotes, sports anecdotes, whatever you want, man. Those are analogies, I mean, to improv, whatever you want.
I want to talk about this. Sure. The last thing I want to talk about. I mean, we didn't get to talk about the Chris Gethard show. We didn't get to talk about a lot of things. I want to hear, since we're just talking about these kind of telling students to be brave and to yes things forever, what's the bravest thing you've done in an improv show? A brave move you had to do that you were maybe scared to do, but you just fucking did it in the name of not being a coward.
There's a lot. Let me think on that. Can I say one thing about the Chris Gethard show? I just recently had a conversation with a student of mine where I actually told her that I'm not as good at improv as I used to be, which I think is true. And then I realized, like, I think that show has become my new attempt to take risks in a way that with improv. Well,
some of those shows have gone great, and some of them have gone not so great. You really are putting – a lot of those shows are really like, well, we're sticking to this, and it's going to work or it won't work.
As far as, like, the stuff I teach, is it bullshit or not? Well, I at the very least swear by – like, stand by it on stage with that. But as an improviser, I don't work as hard as I used to. I just don't. I've been doing it for 10 years, so there's that. I just wanted to – when you brought up the Gethard show, it made me realize –
I don't mind going that way. We can use that as an example. I mean,
as far as that risky stuff, a lot of it's applied there. It's probably scarier to do that risky stuff in something you're writing and taking responsibility for than it is with improv. What have I done that's scary on stage?
Well, maybe that's a lot. I mean, you've had a lot of improv shows, but like...
I feel like I've done some weird shit and I'm known for it.
Maybe when you were younger even, like, I feel like there's moments when you have to, like, take the plunge and put your money where your mouth is of what you think is right and do it, and it doesn't work when you first do it. I feel like there's a time when you're getting better where it's like you're not good enough to do it how you can envision it, but you have to kind of do that anyway.
Yeah, I mean, until those Arsenal catch up. Shows come to mind immediately. Those were pretty scary to, like, keep walking out into that situation. Like, I turned off self-preservation in those shows. Like, those hit a point where I knew all seven members of the team, except maybe Maggie Kemper in certain situations, they all were able to turn off their morals and pick me apart. And I say that, like, kind of judging them for it, kind of not, but keep walking back out there like 20 minutes into a show that had been me being told you're like ugly and have a big head and your teeth don't fit right in your face, we're gonna take your shoes off your feet, take your glasses off, make fun of you some more.
How old were you at that time?
I was like 24, 25 and not a confident person, like pretty sad, and they were exploiting that. So to keep walking out there and doing that, those were some scary instances, but they were shows that
were going over big.
Going over, and I don't really even care about going over big. It was also like, to me, this is far more interesting than, you know, three beats, you know?
Yeah.
So those were really scary. Those come to mind. Torco shows, there's been some, like, playing for a hostile crowd is always scary. It's a show I did in Philadelphia where it was like a riot. That was scary.
Really?
Yeah, where the best thing about that was there was a guy who had contacted us. He wanted to... First of all, they advertised it as the UCB, so everybody thought it was going to be like Amy and Matt and Matt and Ian, and it was like we walked. That was like me and Husky and Bobby, and it was like, oh, shit, 500 of these Philly dudes. And Philly is one of the worst places in America, I think. Like, it's just awful. People there are, like, aggressive. And it was like Husky actually stepped up and got them under control by being hilarious. And this guy had told us he wanted to propose to his girlfriend on stage, and at the end of the show, we were like, oh, shit. So we bring him up, and he goes to do it. But when he gets down on one knee, someone from the back of the room, the whole crowd goes silent, like 400 or 500 people. And from the back of the room, someone goes, say no to that fucking faggot! And the whole crowd was like, aah! Heckling him. Like, that was hard. There's another one where I did a Torco show where they didn't tell us beforehand that it was a benefit for kids with leukemia. And right before us, there was a kid with leukemia giving a speech. And then it was like, ladies and gentlemen, the UCB Touring Co. So those were really scary. Doing a show at Syracuse University where we were told right before the show that a sketch group on campus had put a racist sketch on their TV, shutting down their TV station for the first time in its history. And all the people watching us were there to wait for us to mess up so they could protest comedy. It's like, okay, I'll go do a show.
Yeah, that does not sound too good.
But improv is not that scary to me, because the worst thing that happens is I fuck up real bad and then seven other people either try to fix it or...
Yeah.
It only feels bad when people abandon you. You know what I mean? It doesn't feel bad to try risky things. It only feels bad. It feels worse to watch someone try something and not have its back, you know?
Yeah.
It's scarier, I think, to do stuff like stand up, and like the Gethard show scares me more than improv ever has.
Cool. Well, I think we got to wrap up for time.
And we're losing oxygen.
And we're going to die if we stay in this room much more. No,
getting. Did I talk too much? Was I rude?
You were great. Everybody wonders that, because I and John and I wondered that the first couple weeks we did it. But this is what we've been doing. We've been asking people in the community to come on, and we talk about usually wherever it goes, some memory lane, some philosophy. And thank you very much. It was really good. Shannon, thank you for being here also.
Yeah. Prison Freaks, Monday, June 28th at 9:30.
Yeah. Everybody in improv class is listening to this. You just got to stop being a pussy, okay? That's the main answer to all your problems. People contact me. For some reason, as a teacher, I think maybe I have a reputation for being
nice. You're accessible. Yeah.
So people always contact me. And my advice is, like, you could just, if you want to keep doing it, like, if you really want to do it, you're going to have to just accept the fact that you're going to have to fail 8 million times. And people are going to tell you you're not going to be allowed to be on a team. And people are going to tell you you're not going to be able to get a show. But just keep fucking doing it, and eventually it'll work, you know?
Yeah. I
just
got my persistence and courage beats everything.
By the way, yes. Gethard's fake jerking off while he's saying that.
I'm going to be real jerking off in the bathroom right after this.
Jesus. All right, well, thank you so much, Chris Gethard, for joining the podcast this week. Thank you, Shannon, for being
Nailed it.
Shannon O'Neill. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back next week with John Frusciante back here again. And so please check us out next week. Thanks. Bye. Do 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 do